Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Gerald Sorin, a professor and author of several books, including his newest release, Howard Fast, Life and Literature in the Left Lane, published by Indiana University Press. Sorin, who holds a PhD from Columbia University, is director of Modern Jewish Studies at SUNY New Paltz, and is distinguished teaching professor. An expert in history, politics, and Jewish identity, Sorin received another National Jewish Book Award for Howard Fast, an honor which he also earned for a biography of Irving Howe. Jerry Sorin, my old friend, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Alan.
You know, Howard Fast is somebody that, you know, I grew up reading and think is terrific. But I wanted to ask you what the central thesis of the book is. It seems to those of us who read it and liked it, it has to do with both being a communist and being a Jew. Is that wrong?
Those are two very important themes in the book. And the connection between those two things is also important. His Jewishness contributes to his inclination to join the Communist Party for a whole variety of complex reasons.
Let's start by asking about you, because in order to understand what you have written, it would be good to know where you're coming from. And now let's see. I know that you've written on secular Judaism a lot, and you have, in fact, done remarkable work in that area. But you're not an Orthodox Jew, are you?
Hardly.
That's number one. Number two, you are not and have never been a communist, right?
Not now or ever.
No. So from that perspective, did you like Howard Fast as you studied him?
That's a very interesting question because my mind changed several times. I grew up reading Howard Fast. I would say I teethed politically on Howard Fast. I think I would give Howard Fast credit for helping me move from the center of political consciousness to left of center, significantly left of center. And when I was reading him as a kid, when I was 14 or 15, I had no idea he was a communist. I didn't really even have much of an idea of what that meant. In fact, in my family, there was a great deal of sympathy, and not for the ideology of communism, but for the people who were being attacked by McCarthy. And that seeped into me as well.
Where did you grow up?
In Brownsville, Brooklyn.
And you came from the sort of family that I came from. I remember when Edward R. Murrow went after Joe McCarthy, we taped it on a tape recorder and brought it around to the various places in my junior high school to let all of the classes hear it. So I suspect your family and my family had that in common. But Fast actually ended up going to jail.
Yes, he did, for 3 months on a contempt of Congress conviction, which he appealed twice. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court. They refused to hear the case. It's, I suspect, Howard Fast's finest moment. He refused to name names in 1946 and was cited for contempt, indicted, convicted, and spent his 3 months in jail, finally in 1950. The jail is an interesting story in and of itself. The prison was one of FDR's experimental prisons. There were no walls. There were sticks or posts indicating where the property began and ended, and you weren't supposed to go past those white posts. But it was more like summer camp, and I don't mean to trivialize being away from your family for 3 months and having to stay in one place, but Fast was given good work to do. He loved it. He taught classes at the prison for a while.
And where was the prison?
In West Virginia. I'm trying now to remember the exact name of the prison, Mill something prison. In any case, he ultimately told people that he really enjoyed the experience. And as a writer, he felt it added a dimension and a vision that he could use in his writing. He didn't tell his European comrades who were writing to him in prison that it was a lark. He let them continue to believe that he was being tortured by fascist America.
He was in the gulag.
Yeah, exactly.
Jerry, you started to tell me about that you went back and forth between liking him and not liking him. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit more about that.
I came to writing about him after having found out that he was a communist, and I had a negative inclination in that sense because I have always felt, and especially after my research on the Irving Howe book, that the Communist Party really stood in the way of the emergence of a credible, effective left in the United States. So I was excited about what I would feel as I began to investigate Howard Fast's life and work. Rereading some of the books was a joy. Rereading some of them was a pain. And I would say that what I did discover, and I think I make this fairly clear in the book, is that Howard Fast as a writer, prior to his entrance into the Communist Party, was a very good writer of historical novels. And those historical novels are still in print after 60 and 70 years. His writing, when he was a member of the Communist Party, degenerated. You have some exceptions. A couple of chapters in Spartacus are very well done. And good parts of My Glorious Brothers, which is about the ancient Maccabees and their revolt against oppression and religious discrimination, those are good. But there were seven or eight other books that he wrote within the Communist Party, and they're not good. That's as simple as I can put it. And I think it didn't have to do with the fact that Fast was a Marxist even before he entered the Communist Party. It had to do with the Marxism morphing into party orthodoxy and Stalinism. And I think party orthodoxy meant that you followed the party line in your writing. And I think that kind of heavy-handed imposition of a party line or an ideological obligation is destructive to art.
They paid him, didn't they, the communists?
No, not really.
Well, I don't mean they paid him. Here's your check for being a faithful communist. I mean, he got a lot of the money he got from his royalties.
Absolutely.
From the Soviet bloc.
Absolutely. In fact, as opposed,
I should just say, Jerry, just for the sake of being contentious, many other writers who didn't get their royalties, even though their books were published in those places.
That's correct. That especially was true after 56, 57 and the so-called secret Khrushchev report and the occupation of Hungary by the Soviet Union. But Fast made a lot of money from his book sales in the Soviet Union. He already was very wealthy by the time he was, I would say, graylisted. By that I mean there was no official blacklist in publishing, though publishers were reluctant to put out a book with Howard Fast's name on the cover after he was cited for contempt of Congress.
How many books did he write with a pseudonym?
He wrote several books with a pseudonym. He wrote under the name of Walter Erickson, one book, but he wrote 20 books under the name of E.V. Cunningham. The interesting thing about that is he didn't start writing those books until after he was sort of cleared out of the Communist Party, but he was fearful that he would still be discriminated against.
Was he? I mean, in other words, did he ever outlive, you know, the Marxist sort of imprimatur?
As far as his audience is concerned, absolutely. And as far as publishers are concerned, absolutely. I'm not sure he ever got out from under a Marxist and even communist consciousness, because as late as 1968, his son, Jonathan, who was a teacher of psychiatric social work, visited on a school trip in 1968. He was part of a choir, saw the Soviet Union, many parts of it, came back telling his father that the Soviet Union isn't what you think it is. There are lots of lines and there are lots of shortages and people want to buy my blue jeans and my ballpoint pens. And it's just a bunch of little capitalists running around trying to buy something from you to sell to somebody else. And Howard Fast said, "You didn't go to the right places."
He always had those lines.
Right. And even later, when he was very wealthy, multimillionaire, he said to his son, "Wouldn't it be nice," maybe he was feeling guilty about all that money, I'm not sure, "wouldn't it be nice if there were a communist revolution somewhere in the world?" And Jonathan then gave him a list of nation states that call themselves communist, and he said, fasted, that's not communism, that's not real communism. Someday, the real revolution will come. So even as he worked his way back into the literary mainstream and had a second career, so to speak, he never really dropped that dream.
In that, Gerald Soren, professor, he was a lot like Marx himself. In other words, Marx defined a pure Marxist theory, and this is what you're telling me Fast thought might happen someday.
Yes. I don't think Fast had the theoretical sophistication that Karl Marx had. And Marx, as you know, never really spelled out what a communist world or society would look like, nor did Fast, but he thought that was inevitable, the future was inevitable, and that history would end with the ultimate revolution to end all revolutions.
Let's talk a little bit about his work. What's his best book?
I believe his best book, and this is a subjective thing, I will get an argument from others, but was The Last Frontier. And that was written in 1941, several years before he joined the Communist Party. And The Last Frontier is about the Cheyenne Indians and their attempt to escape from their reservation in Oklahoma and to get back to their homelands in the Dakotas and Montana and Wyoming. And it's a very sensitive, very beautifully written book. And it had an enormous impact on me because that story about the entrapment of the American Indians and their unwillingness to stay in place and the dignity with which they escaped from their oppression and their dedication to getting home was not being taught to me in school. So I thought, how at Fast is it going to be a source for me of a different kind of education? And that's why I continued reading him. I don't really think it's only because I like this book personally and because it had such an impact on me politically. I think that it's the best written of all his books.
And Freedom Road?
Freedom Road is a wonderful social protest novel. It's not literature. It was very, very painful for me to go back and read it because it's wooden in its writing style. But the story is still a very powerful story about blacks trying to live after the Civil War, during the Reconstruction period, on an abandoned plantation and live in a self-deterministic way, make their own way in what was clearly a Ku Klux Klan South. And it looked good for a while, but they were wiped out entirely by a Ku Klux Klan gang during the night, were attacked, everybody was killed. The story is based on a chapter in W.E.B. Du Bois's Black Reconstruction in America, a very, very important book. It's interesting that Fast used that as a source but never gave Du Bois any credit for it. It changed consciousness for some people who were already perhaps leaning in that direction. There's a funny story about Dashiell Hammett and Lillian Hellman. Dashiell Hammett read the book. He writes a letter to Lillian Hellman.
The famous detective novel.
Yes.
Yes, novelist, yes.
Yeah, and he was also in the Communist Party, but he never admitted to it. And so was she, Lillian Hellman. And he said, you know, I don't like Fast's book as literature, that is Freedom Road, but it has its place. And he said, Fast's stuff has its place. Several people have asked me whether they could get a hold of copies after they read it because they wanted to distribute it to friends. And it really, as he put it, Dashiell Hammett, opened their eyes to what was going on down in the Old South. So it played a very important educational role. Literature, it's not.
But it was censored, wasn't it? In other words, a lot of school districts wouldn't allow it to be used, even though it has this phenomenal reputation.
That's true. I did an informal survey of students, teachers, ordinary readers, and I got a lot of stories about Freedom Road that students learned something they weren't learning in school about slavery, about the Civil War, about Reconstruction, about black ability and equality that they weren't learning in school. But the teachers did not assign that book. And I got one letter from a young woman who said, when she confronted her teacher about that, he said, "I don't want to get into trouble."
Hmm.
The book that was, in fact, banned, officially banned, from the New York public school system was Citizen Tom Paine. Why was it banned?
Let's talk about that book. Very important, wasn't it?
Yes, because Tom Paine was the most radical of the founding fathers.
Indeed.
And he had an idea about a kind of social welfare state. And he even had a plan to raise the taxes to finance that state. And he was mistreated by his so-called founding fathers' colleagues. That is, they liked him for a while because he enabled them to gather the forces together to get that revolution done. But they didn't want to go any further than the bourgeois revolution that was made by the merchants, planters, and professionals. He had his eye on working class people.
Did he see himself? Do you think Fast saw himself as a sort of Tom Paine?
In a way, yes, because he wanted to go further, obviously, than the bourgeois revolution, just like Tom Paine did. And Fast pulled himself up by his own bootstraps. He was born very poor. He was virtually abandoned. He lost his mother when he was 8 years old, and his father was never around. He was either looking for work or working very long hours, making him exhausted by the time he came home. So Howard hardly ever saw his father and never really got to know his mother, and his older sister left the home, and he was a virtually abandoned child. Tom Paine has a lot of that in his past, certainly born poor and having to struggle to rise out of poverty by pulling up on his own bootstraps.
You mentioned that he didn't give credit to Du Bois. We here at WMC are very interested in Du Bois because he's a native of Great Barrington. But he had a couple of struggles with accusations of plagiarism, didn't he?
Howard Fast.
Yes.
Yes, unfortunately. Du Bois did not hold it against Howard Fast that he wasn't credited in the book. Du Bois was a figure of some repute, even though he was black and discriminated against. And in fact, the United States government during the McCarthy period tried to get him deported. And Du Bois didn't join the Communist Party till he was 93 years old. Mm-hmm. So just an interesting story in Ghana. Interesting story in and of itself. But as far as Fast's, in quotes, plagiarism is concerned, there were several instances of it. He wrote a book on Chaim Salomon.
Just for those who may be out there who have no idea who Chaim Salomon was, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about
it. Okay, Chaim Salomon was a Jewish financier during the revolutionary period, loaned money to many of the leaders of the American Revolution, including James Madison. He died impoverished and died.
Because he'd given it all away to the...
He had given it all away. He also made some bad investments. The post-revolutionary period was a very bad period economically in what had become the United States of America. And he was neglected by the people he helped.
But not in contemporary Hebrew schools, I can tell you that much.
No. No. We need our roots, you know. We have to go back into history as far as we can. We didn't come over on the Mayflower, but we had Thomas Paine.
And we had Chaim Salomon.
and Chaim Salomon. Thomas Paine, I mention only because he was the least prejudiced about Jews of the whole lot of them. Well, there was a book by Charles Edward Russell, who was something of a muckraker in the 1930s. He wrote a book on Chaim Salomon, and Fast's book is virtually a paraphrase of that book.
Interesting.
And nobody notices this and has never noticed it until people were trying to work on Howard Fast and looked back at Russell's book and said, "This sounds very familiar." So there was that case. There was another case where Howard Fast wrote a book called The American.
Yep.
And it was about Governor Altgeld of Illinois, and it was about the anarchists. And it wasn't, again, not a very good book. It's fragmented. There's no coherent plot, but it showed where his heart was. Of course, the Communist Party hated that book because it was about anarchism, and they hated the anarchists. They hated anybody who was not a communist.
They hated anybody who wasn't them.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And anybody who wasn't them was a fascist in one form or another. So, you know, name-calling and political correctness and all of that.
In fact, but, I hate to go in all these directions, but in fact, you know, he had been on a couple of occasions during his time in the party censored by the communists for not being appropriately within the confines of their ideology.
That is a very important story in the book, and it happened almost every single time he published the book.
Really?
Now, he never had to turn over an unpublished manuscript to the party. Their censorship was indirect. But they had many instruments of control, if I may say, dressing down, denunciation, severe criticism in their presses, and the threat of expulsion. And people who had invested a good number of their years in the party were very fearful of expulsion because they had already cut themselves off from non-communist friends. They didn't know even how to operate in a non-communist world. Communism became their life. And so no matter how many times Howard Fast was slapped on the wrist or embarrassed or humiliated, he stayed in. He writes Freedom Road. Prior to his entrance into the Communist Party, shows the book to people he wants to please, his superiors in the Cultural Commission, and they are livid about it because, first of all, he uses the N-word throughout.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it wasn't Django Unchained or anything like that. It wasn't time for that in that era. But Fast defended himself and said that's the way people spoke. And it would be a lie to have them talking more politely about this subject. Also, the Soviet Union, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, had a changed policy on blacks and black self-determination. In 1928, they were all for black self-determination in the United States where blacks were in the majority or in a large minority of the population. By 1936, during the Popular Front, when the communists were, sincerely or otherwise, reaching out for allies, they said, no, no self-determination, we're all in this together, integration is the goal. And along comes Howard Fast with a book called Freedom Road, which emphasizes black self-determination. So he says, what did I do wrong? And they said, this is a deviant approach. You are moving into a tendency that's very dangerous. Those were two words, by the way, the communists love. Deviant and tendency. And
he apologized, so, didn't he?
Not only apologized, he promised to mend his ways and to rid himself of bourgeois residue. I don't know how one goes about that. There's no pill, I don't think. But
But the communists were famous for making people apologize.
Yes.
One way or another.
Yes. And in fact, they did try to make people change their work. Bud Schulberg's What Makes Sammy Run, written in 1939. Schulberg was so criticized. They said, this is a middle-class novel. It needs to be about the proletariat. Rewrite the book. Schulberg quit the party. He hadn't been in it for that long. Fast did not quit the party. 1947, Fast writes a book called Clarkton. He thinks, wow, now I've got it. It's a modern book. It's about a strike in New England. It's led by communists. They're all portrayed as demigods. What could the party have against this? Well, Fast had painted the capitalist, George Lowell, who owned the mill at which the strike was taking place, as too human. He had human characteristics. Capitalists must not be painted as human beings. That's a chilling idea, isn't it? Because if you put people outside of the category of human, you can do anything you want to them.
We are talking to Professor Gerald Sorin. The book is Howard Fast, Life and Literature in the Left Lane. Jerry, I've read a lot of Fast, certainly not as much as you have, but I notice, and I think you've sort of indicated this, that some of them are much better than others. And I'm wondering about that. I mean, you know, you read a book and you say, well, this is a very cohesive book. It has Bingham and Millenand. It has, and this one is disjointed. And he was prolific. He wrote a lot of books. So I think I may have mentioned this to you once. I got to thinking that maybe he didn't do all his own work. Is that possible?
I don't think that that's true. I mean, I do think he depended on other authors. I think that, as we all do, I mean, there is an anatomy of influence as...
If you're an academic, but you know how to do it the right way. I mean, you know,
right.
Use a footnote.
I mean, yes, a footnote is important. An attribution is important. That's the kind of thing. But he saw himself as a historical novelist that did not have to do that kind of thing. It's fiction, after all. That's an excuse he used when he was charged with being historically inaccurate or having the wrong interpretation about historical events. But then when he was charged with, you know, not telling the story correctly as far as the communist point of view is concerned, he would slip back into his other role and say, look, you know, novelists can also write history, and I haven't changed anything. All of that was nonsense. Many of his stories are simply not true. And he didn't claim that many of them were true, but when he did, he got himself into a lot of trouble. He wanted to be a historian and a fiction writer, not an impossible synthesis, but he couldn't pull it off. I think that the key, for me, the key distinction is books he wrote before he entered the Communist Party, books he wrote within the Communist Party, books he wrote after the Communist Party. The books in the Communist Party are the least good books. And that's because of the feeling that he had to please the cultural commissars in the party.
Jerry Sorin, one of the things that people, you know, go along and say about the communists of the time, my friends, you know, who I knew who were in the party and during that time, is that they were well-meaning people, that they were not, you know, the sort of Bolshevik pounding on the table, we will bury you type people. They just wanted to make things better. True or not true in terms of the case of Howard Fast?
Well, I thought you were going to ask me about the ordinary communist who stayed in the party
sure.
an average of 3 years. In fact, it was a typical stay, not only an average
sure.
stay. Here's a guy who stayed in for 14 years. I don't think that what you said about your friends who were in the Communist Party is true of Howard Fast. Howard Fast was a revolutionary. He believed that communism would not come to the United States without a revolution. He believed that change was extremely necessary in the socioeconomic system. He was willing to wait it out, and he didn't fight against incremental reform like some communists did and who said that...
They hated Roosevelt because he was...
Don't reform the system because then we won't be able to overthrow
it. Sure.
And Fast was a supporter of Roosevelt. He wasn't all that crazy. He could get something out of the New Deal that would be moving in the direction of social justice. But ultimately, he knew what was going on in the Soviet Union. He knew what Stalin was doing.
He did.
Yes.
That's fascinating.
That is, and it's disturbing. And that's the point in the book, in my research, I should say, where I had another change. Because I thought, okay, if we can give him the break of saying he had no idea what was going on in the Soviet Union, he never visited the Soviet Union. Unfortunately, he knew what was going on in the Soviet Union, even in terms of Jews, even in terms of increasing murderous anti-Semitism, and he kept it to himself. He went to the Paris Peace Conference in 1949, which was organized by the International Communist Movement, and he met there a man who he had corresponded with, Fadayev, who was the head of the Soviet Writers' Union. And he said to Fadayev, you know, we have rumors back home that there's anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union. And I am being charged by the Jewish Commission of the Communist Party of New York to ask you about that. And Fadayev just kept saying, there is no anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union. That must have happened 10 times. But finally, and now we know because the archives have been opened and so much has been published, Fadayev actually lost his temper, screamed at Fast that there is a Zionist conspiracy to overthrow the Soviet Union. The Jewish Joint Distribution Committee and some other minor organizations based in Crimea somehow will overthrow this great socialist experiment. I mean, it's ridiculous on its face of it that the Jews would have that kind of a power to overthrow one of the mightiest empires, I have to call it, in world history. But what does Fast do with that news? Because what has Fadayev done but admit that there is negative treatment of Jews in the Soviet Union, but there's a reason for it. They are traitors. They are counter-revolutionaries. They're trying to overthrow our system. So Fast goes home and reports this to two or three people who were interested in that question. Paul Novick, for example, who was the editor of the Freiheit, a Yiddish language communist newspaper. And they take it no further. Either they don't want to believe him, they can't believe him, or they know he's telling the truth, but they may believe that it's historically necessary to do what Stalin is doing in order to make the world better. Historical necessity, and Fast bought into that concept of historical necessity. Now, do anything that you need to do to get to the goal you want to achieve.
Now, Jerry, in reading the book, The Howard Fast, Life and Literature in the Left Lane, I thought you made something of the fact that it really took the Khrushchev secret memoirs to convince Fast of what was going on. So in other words, I'm a little confused here by your assertion that he knew everything, and then to read in the book that it took the Khrushchev memoir to convince him.
That's an interesting question, and it speaks to the subjectivity of these people and the psychology.
It also speaks to the fact that I read the book.
I certainly have recognized that by now. I was prepared for you to read the book, Alan. A lot of people expressed horror after the Khrushchev secret speech in 1956, but they too also knew in part of their psyche what was going on.
Sure.
They just simply couldn't face it. They were in what we might call denial, or they dismissed these things as bourgeois atrocity mongering, as Fast himself did. But he knew better. He did know better. When Khrushchev's speech was publicized and translated into English, all he said was he didn't know the extent of the anti-Semitism. But most other things he knew.
Well, we knew about the doctor's plot, for example.
Exactly.
Things of that kind.
In fact, in 1953, there was an accusation against Jewish doctors that they were trying to poison Stalin and his entourage. And interestingly enough, Stalin dies only a few months after that. So some people were confirmed in their notion that the Jews poisoned Stalin. And Jews, it wasn't the first time in history that Jews were accused of poisoning things. But Fast was absent at a meeting of the National Professional Science Artists Association, which was a communist front organization. And they took a vote. Two relatively moderate liberals, left liberals, professors, law professors, wrote a resolution criticizing the Soviet Union and comparing what they were doing in 1953 with the doctor's plot with Nazi Germany. Fast was not at the meeting. They asked for his vote. They sent him a letter. I've seen that letter. I've seen his answer. Why he kept those smoking guns, I have no idea. But his answer was that it would be easier for him to believe that Israel, which was 5 years old at that point, and other Jewish organizations around the world were indeed trying to overthrow the Soviet Union before he would believe that Jews were being victimized in the Soviet Union. That really surprised me. That really shocked me. I thought maybe, all right, even if you think that or approach thinking that, you put that in writing and you send it to a major Communist Front organization and you save the letter in your files. I was a little taken aback by that. And you know, Fass got involved in the defense of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg.
Indeed.
And I think, well, I won't go into that case in detail, but injustice was done. They may have been guilty. In fact, Julius was certainly guilty, but the death penalty was an obscenity in that context. Nobody else had been punished in that way for the same crimes and worse. So Fast, okay, he's doing something admirable there. However, the communists do not get involved in the Rosenberg trial until they have to hide the fact that in Czechoslovakia, Jews are being strung up. Former communists, men and women who had won medals of honor from the Communist Party, now being accused of counter-revolutionary tendencies or deviances. It was famous among some people, the Slansky case, Rudolf Slansky. It was only after they had to cover up the Slansky case that the Communist Party officially got involved with the Rosenberg case. They wanted to create a sensational moment which would draw attention away from what the Stalinists were.
Fascinating. I mean, that is fascinating. I wanted to ask you about his sex life. Yes. I mean, you make much of it in the thing. I mean, he was unapologetic. You know, he liked the ladies, and he did his thing.
He certainly did. He had an affair early on in his marriage. Well, yeah, 6 years into it, I guess. He was working at the Office of War Information, and he was working late at night with a beautiful young woman, apparently, who was a Bennington student. And they were alone in the office, and they would close up and go out for a drink afterwards. And as Howard Fast said, when a man and a beautiful woman are put together for so long a period of time, things happen. Now, my wife, Myra, who is my best editor, wrote in the margins of that page, if you let them. Things happen if you let them. That put a crimp in the marriage, and there was a lot of trouble and tension between Betty Fast, originally Betty Cohen, now Fast's wife. And he kept apologizing over and over and over again, but he didn't change his behavior. He had an affair with Isabel Johnson, who later became the wife of Alger Hiss, but much later. She was a beautiful model. If you see pictures of her, you would not disagree. And she was photographed by the most famous photographers in the world. What she saw in Fast, I have no idea.
I was going to say that. Fast is not exactly the model of, you know, the most handsome guy in the world.
No. And he had poor eyesight. He was balding. He was only 5'10". But
hey,
he was...
Watch that.
I know. Well, I'm shorter than you, Alan. But there is a cachet, I guess, in being a famous writer and notorious in the news at that point. And I guess that has a kind of glamour to it. Yes, an aphrodisiac.
Sure.
The power. Yeah.
Do you think there was anything about his leftism and his sexuality that's concomitant in his mind?
Possibly, only because of the free love concept that extreme radicals say they adhere to. But I don't think he joined the party or stayed in the party because he thought he'd have more sexual opportunities. I do believe that Howard Fast was sincerely dedicated to social justice as he saw it. And that was the main reason for entering the party. Though, you do raise a good point there. Before he joined the party, he went to Hollywood to try to sell his Tom Paine novel as a screenplay. And he met many of the Hollywood Ten, who were living in very glamorous surroundings.
I think we have to tell everybody that the Hollywood Ten themselves were suspected of communism and, in fact, convicted of it.
Yes, and they were self-admitted communists later.
Yeah.
They lived opulently, and they were surrounded by glamorous women. And Howard Fast was very attracted to this environment. And what he realized, and here I'm being a little speculative because we can't get into the minds of these characters, but it sure looked this way from his letters and his reactions, that here he had an opportunity to be among these people. They're smart, they're communists, they know more about world politics than he ever knew, and they're surrounded by beautiful women. I can do all that and still keep my integrity as a leftist. So there is that kind of connection.
Tell me about HUAC. He appears before House Un-American Activities Committee, he appears before the Senate. They go after him with everything they have. And yet we know Stalin was a dangerous character. Now, I was raised, as I'm sure you were, and you mentioned it earlier, that these were very bad people, the HUAC people, the McCarthy people, and the rest of it. But is there any thinking on your part based on the fact that Stalin was so bad? Pete Seeger, my very good friend, talks about, you know, you never want to trust a dictator. And, you know, I wonder about all of that.
Well, if you're suggesting that there's a moral equivalence between HUAC and McCarthy on the one side and Stalin...
I'm not suggesting anything. Okay. I'm just asking.
Well, I think they deserved one another in a sense. Mm-hmm. And I'll throw the FBI in there as well. McCarthy was a serial slanderer.
But indeed.
McCarthyism started, oddly enough, before McCarthy.
Sure.
We had the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1938 institutionalized an anti-communist sentiment in America that had been there since 1919. But McCarthy comes to power in the early 1950s, and the Republicans win the election in 1952, so he gets even more power, and his internal subcommittee for... The Senate went after a lot of people, suspects. HUAC, to its credit, only went after people for whom they had a lot of evidence that they were, in fact, in the Communist Party and may have been involved in subversive activities. It wasn't a witch hunt in that sense, where they went.
There'll be a lot of people disagree with you.
I know. Yeah. I know. But as you noticed, I never used that word in the book because it wasn't as if people were accusing, when they were accused, other people who are innocent, which is my definition of what a witch hunt is. And then everybody assumes the accused is guilty. Now, among the public, people who are accused who are innocent, there may have been a developed prejudice, a job lost, that kind of thing. But HUAC itself did not go after anyone except really high-level communists. And even Victor Navasky, in naming names, says this. He gives them their due. But 7 years later, with McCarthy's committee in the Senate, that's another story. They are tarring with a very wide brush. Everybody who says anything progressive is seen as a communist. Communist became a name you could call somebody and end an argument. Communism was a way of just avoiding the argument. So I think that was a very bad time in American history. And Fast felt that tension and was angry about it. He exaggerated it way out of proportion. He said that the United States is three steps into the five steps toward fascism. And he kept repeating that over and over again. He thought that the Rosenberg execution was a function of fascism and of anti-Semitism. He tried to convince Jewish people in New York that they were being targeted by the United States government. Jewish people in New York in the 1950s, for them, it was a golden age. They had come through the Holocaust, or their relatives had, some of them, and they were disproportionately represented in the professions. They were doing very well economically. The state of Israel was already 5 or 6 or 7 years old. There was a sense of self-confidence that Jews had made it in America. And here comes Howard Fast to tell them, look, you're next. They're executing these black people. They're lynching them in the South. And tomorrow they're going to come for you. There were no willing ears open to that kind of stuff.
So you started, when we started talking about this, about these two profound influences in Fast's, you know, makeup, the communism and the Judaism. But he was a secular Jew.
Yes.
And so the question then becomes, what did it mean to him to be Jewish?
That is very interesting. He's secular, but he was invested in what I would call the prophetic tradition. That is, Isaiah was his favorite part of the Hebrew Scriptures.
Tell us about Isaiah.
Well, Isaiah was, I guess, could be considered the socialist of his day. And the biggest thing was communal responsibility, that people had an obligation to take care of people. A lot of us ought to be reading that book now, but that was the key message. And that the widows, the orphans, the poor need to be looked after. In fact, your brother next door has to be looked after. The stranger has to be looked after. We have mutual obligations to one another. There is a social contract. Sound familiar?
Yes.
He also thought that Jesus was the ultimate Jew. What we call in the tradition Lamed Vav, which is the Hebrew letters for 36. The legend is that there are 36 people alive on earth at any given time who are so good that they're holding the earth up from falling apart through their continual goodness. And he saw Jesus as one of these people. And he has a kind of fixation on this. Jesus appears in a lot of his writings. He writes short stories about Jesus. Occasionally he uses the word Christ, which was interesting to me, but that would be another whole book. Because for Christians, Christ means the Messiah, the person who has come and redeemed our souls through his own sacrifice. Jesus is a historical person.
But it could be argued that Spartacus is his most important book in terms of popular consumption.
Yes, but that's pre-Jesus.
Of course.
But there are scenes in that book which resemble the crucifixion.
Sure.
There was a massive crucifixion. But there's one scene in which the last slave rebel to be crucified is David. He's Jewish. He's on a cross. There's a woman standing below the cross, weeping, hoping that he can survive. And in fact, David's words echo Jesus' words, or they have the same kind of rhythm. Why hast thou forsaken us? So there was this attempt at synthesis of the best in Christianity and the best in Jewishness.
So did he believe in God?
No. Not in the sense that there was an anthropomorphic, transcendental being that could intervene in the world and change things. He did not believe in God. He saw himself as a Jew, but that took some time also. He wasn't raised as a Jew. There was nobody at home. He went to Hebrew school, and he hated
it. Yeah, but they told him he was a Jew.
He told him he was a Jew, right.
Just like they told all the rest of us that
right.
We were Jewish.
And he got beat up because he was Jewish. In the streets.
That'll make you a Jew.
That'll make you a Jew, right. But it's just almost serendipitous. He's asked to write a history of the Jews in 1940 after he's published now 3 or 4 novels and that he's seen as a good writer.
Yeah.
So the Hebrew Publishing Company says, write a history of the Jews.
Turns out to be an important book.
A very, very important book. And to Fast and his life. Because he says, me? Write the book? I don't know anything about Judaism or Jewishness. So Isidore Werbel, who was the president of the Hebrew Publishing Company, says to Fast, come on down, choose any books you want, take as much time as you want. I know you can do it. So he goes down and he gets the massive 19-volume Encyclopedia Judaica plus a bunch of other books and just spends months and months and months reading intensely and says, I've discovered my heritage. I taught myself to be Jewish by doing that book.
But he's a smart man.
He is smart.
Very smart man. And, you know, I mean, when you read your book, Jerry Sorin, you get the idea that, you know, he can fool around with logic and the rest of it, but that he's really a smart guy.
Yeah, I don't think you could write the books he wrote without being smart. I mean, they were successful in the best sense of that word. They were critically admired as well as popular. And you can't do much better than that as a writer.
I want to go back. We haven't spent enough time on you, Jerry Sorin, because you're one impressive fellow. But I want to talk to you just for a couple of seconds about the Resnick lectures. And you mentioned Isaiah, and you mentioned taking care of each other. Tell us a little about the Resnick lectures and what you've done there.
The Resnicks, Mildred and Lewis from Ellenville, were very active in the Democratic Party in Ulster County. And they made a lot of money. Interestingly enough, I'll just tell
Channel you. Channelmaster.
Channelmaster, okay, you know the story. He was a farmer before he went into the Army. He invented Channelmaster after he came out of the Army. Of course, they had him in the electronics division. He and his brothers put this thing together, and, you know, the rabbit ears, everybody had the rabbit ears for their TV. And then he made good investments. And he was very dedicated to the Democratic Party and to the Jewish community. He asked SUNY New Paltz, when Alice Chandler was president, what he could do for SUNY New Paltz Jewish studies. Alice asked me to write a proposal for a program, and we did. And he liked it for a lecture series named in his honor. And it was an attempt to educate the non-Jewish public about Jewish history, Jewish life, Jewish values, and to bring town and gown together. The lectures are open to everyone, and we've covered the waterfront, so to speak, in terms of topics. We started in 1989, so we're 25 years into doing this, and it's a great joy for me to see people come from the community onto the campus and to participate with us.
Well, it's amazing. Our guest has been Dr. Gerald Sorin, whose new book is Howard Fast, Life and Literature in the Left Lane, published by Indiana University Press. Jerry, you, of course, have always been one of the most impressive people at New Paltz. We taught together for years and years, and I always have had profound respect for you, and I want you to know how grateful we are that you're here today.
The feeling's mutual, Alan.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.